Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com, worldwide. And I'm delighted to meet somebody that I've known, you know, probably for the bulk of the last 60 years, believe it or not. And he is John Donoghue, though nobody would know him by that name because we know him as Chick Donoghue, Chicky Donoghue, and, you know, a former United States Marine. And first of all, you're very welcome there, Chicky.
Thank you.
Now, let me, for our listeners, can you explain to us, or at least give us a bit of flavor of Inwood, back when you grew up there, and how Irish was it, and you know, just a little background there.
Well, if you look at the map, Inwood is the northern tip of Manhattan Island, and it's surrounded on three sides by water: the Hudson on the west, the Harlem River on the east, and Spike and Dival on the north. And then Washington Heights is actually the Heights there. So it's an Irish and Jewish neighborhood that I grew up in there, in Inwood. And it was, what can I say, we felt isolated. We felt we were not unique, but different than most neighborhoods that extended to the next neighborhood and the next neighborhood and the next neighborhood. For most of the time, you needed to cross a river or a bridge to get out of Inwood. So then we had our own woods there. We had a forest there, Inwood Hill Park, still there today. And I love to tell people, when I was a young boy growing up in Inwood, I thought every neighborhood had a castle because of the cloisters.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yes, but it was just a lovely neighborhood to be a boy in, that's all.
Now, hanging out in one of the numerous pubs there, most of them Irish, the Irish pubs, tell us about, the one in particular that is mentioned and in books that have been written, and now in a movie that is considered to be, first of all, the movie is called The Greatest Beer Run Ever, and it looks like it might be one of the best movies of 2022. Indeed, it just opened last night, and was heading for theaters all across the country. Let me ask you, Chicky, about the particular pub where, you know, where you got Doc Fiddler's. You know, you're 26 year old. It was November of 1967, and you know, a Marine. So you're hanging out in Doc Fiddler's with the. First of all, it was one of the number of bars that dotted that neighborhood. But it was an Irish-American conclave. I doubt very much you saw many other ethnic groups hanging out there. It was, and again, take us to Doc Fiddler's and the famous night that some would say you took on the craziest of, you know, undertaking ever that anybody did, and the fact that you lived through it was a miracle in itself. Bring us there.
Well, it was 1967, as you say. It was the beginning of November, and the winter was beginning, the chill was coming in the air, and I was a merchant seaman by trade. That was my trade then. I was a sailor on merchant ships. And it was normal for me. I would come home in the late spring, spend the summer in Inwood, or Rockaway Beach or the shore or wherever we went and up to the mountains, to the Catskills in particular. And they go back in the early fall. And that's where I was at that situation in 67 November when I experienced a demonstration in Central Park really bothered me. First of all, Inwood had buried a lot of young men who had died tragically in the Vietnam War. And so we were sensitive to the troops because, again, it was a tight little neighborhood. And when there was a funeral mass going on in Good Shepherd, the whole neighborhood knew it. And it was frequent, and they were often with the military display about them and all. And after witnessing that demonstration on Central Park, I went up to the neighborhood. I went to Doc Fiddler's. It was on Sherman Avenue and Isham Street, right across the street from another Inwood bar, Chambers. But Chambers was more of a cop bar. A lot of policemen off duty and whatever hung out from there. Doc Fiddler's was not a police bar, so it was more open to the general public. All sorts of people who wouldn't like to go into cop bars would come into Doc Fiddler's. But anyway, it had a famous bartender. His name was George Lynch, and we affectionately referred to him as the Colonel, and respectfully. So I was telling him about the demonstration I witnessed, and then he turned on the 6 o'clock news, and here it was on the 6 o'clock news. So the conversation went into, this is a shame. While our guys are over there dying, these traitors are marching around in Central Park with the communist flags and saluting Ho Chi Minh. And it was just terrible, disgusting, and very sad. But there was nothing we could do about it. What could you do about it? And Lynch made a crazy suggestion. He said, you know, I'd like to go over there. I wish I could get over there and see all them guys and buy them all a drink or bring them all a drink, all right? He was a bartender, so that's what we saluted people. And I said, I could do that, George. I'm getting ready to go to sea, and it's warm there. I usually head for the warm climates in the wintertime. So that's how it started. And I think I could do it? You think I said, all I needed was their military addresses. The fact that I was only a couple of years out of the Marines, I knew the lingo and, and how mail ran and everything. So I was comfortable in that climate with the military in charge. And I had been to Vietnam 3 times before. Believe it or not, the first ship I took over there, I had a shipload of beer, just beer. American beer. So I knew, in fact, that there was plenty of beer in Vietnam.
Hmm.
But I still brought a couple of cases just in case I didn't reach anybody before I could, get a load of it. But that's how it started, Adrian.
Yeah. And, Chucky, that was the favorite beer, at least at that time anyway, or the beer of Inwood was Pabst Blue Ribbon. Now, did Pabst Blue Ribbon at any point say, okay, we'll give you a hand with this, or was this two guys in a pub and joined by friends there saying, we don't need, we don't need any sponsors here, and Chickie Donahue decides that he's going to do it himself without any sponsorship?
Well, there was no talk of what kind of beer or anything like that. There was no great discussion on beer, the label at least. That all came about after we wrote the book. And I decided to use a documentary, a short documentary, to help sell the book because the book was self-published. We had to sell it ourselves.
Yeah.
I was carrying books around to different places, giving talks and selling my book. But anyway, once Andrew Mascaro did that 12-minute video that went on the air, it's now over 1 million views, they tell me, somebody saw it. Peter Farrelly, in fact, was the person who saw it. And then requested the book, got the book, and then he called me and told me he wanted to make a movie of it. But the name didn't come up about Pabst Blue Ribbon until we did the 12-minute documentary.
Yeah.
And one of the guys says, well, tell us the name of a beer. Give us the name of a beer. So I just drew Pabst Blue Ribbon out there.
Sure, yeah. Chick Donahue, the greatest beer run ever. Walk us through, well, first of all, a couple of questions, like, you know, getting to Vietnam, you knew the ropes, as you've indicated, you had that one down pat, but when you got to Vietnam, did anybody, was it the military equivalent of customs or, you know, checking? How did you manage that one, considering you were not an active member at that point?
Well, technically, the ship I was a crew member on, the SS Drake Victory, an old World War II victory ship, was under contract to the military. In fact, all it had as cargo was ammunition. So, technically, I was working for the military.
Okay.
So, when there is no customs. There was never customs. Them 500,000 soldiers that and Marines and airmen, sailors that were in Vietnam in 1967, they didn't go through customs to get there. They flew in militarily or they came over on military ships. So, technically, we were under contract to the Navy. And yeah. So, we were U.S. Navy ship. So we didn't have any customs or any immigration or anything like that.
Yeah. But you showed up at the ship, and did anyone ask you where you were going or were you on assignment or how did you get on the ship to begin with?
Well, I went down to the Union Hall. It was the National Maritime Union at the time. Now it's the Seafarers International Union. And they were right across the street from St. Vincent's Hospital on 7th Avenue. And the building is still there today. It has, you can see the maritime features of the building. So that was the hiring hall for the Port of New York. So I went down there, and the system was very simple. When you came off a ship, you would go to the Union Hall and you'd register as on the beach, on shore, vacation, whatever you want to call it. And they give you a card, and it's stamped at the time you went into that Union Hall the first time, and the date and everything. So I come back, say, 2-3 months later, after spending the summer in Inwood, and my card would have been 2 or 3 months, we'd call it, old. So I was that long on the beach, so I would be the first one picked if I was qualified for the certain job that was called for on the ships in and out of the port. So I was, I could have been a number of jobs, but one job I did often was the oiler's job.
Okay.
So I went in and I looked up on the board and there was a ship listed on the board, a big black bulletin board, and it was located in Leonardo, New Jersey. Well, I knew that Leonardo, New Jersey was really the pier for an ammunition dump. There was nothing out there but that one pier. And that was for ammunition, and it came out of Leonardo, New Jersey. So I knew it was an ammunition ship, which meant there was the military, and it didn't say where it was going, but I knew for sure, 90% chance that it was going to Vietnam. So I went up, threw my card in, and they call it a pierhead. I didn't find that out until I threw the card in, that they it was sailing that day. So I literally had like 3 or 4 hours before the ship was scheduled to sail to get out to Leonardo, New Jersey, and sail away. So that was the first part. It worked. I got on the ship, and the ship sailed. But one of the things I've always did on ships was I grew up a trade unionist. My father was a great union man. And every ship that I was on, I either ran for the delegate of one of the departments, or the chairman of the union council on the ship, which is what I did, thinking that if I had a chance of getting a couple of days off while we were in port in Vietnam, it would be better if I was the ship's union representative.
Yeah.
You know, I'd get a better hearing. So that's why I did that. But I would have done that anyway. And then I worked ships for the different oilers on a cruise over. It was 31 days just from the Pacific side of the Panama Canal to Vietnam. And so the point is that I drank all the beer I had with me on the way across the Pacific. And thank God I knew there was beer in Vietnam. I was able to refill it.
My guest, Chick Donegat, if you can take us through the maneuvering. So now you're in Vietnam, and again, you had some story that must have come to you either pre-planned or not, and that is that you were on. You wanted to find your friends, obviously, you made up a story about looking for your stepbrother, this Rick Dugan. Was there a Rick Dugan ever?
There was, and there still is a Rick Dugan.
Oh!
And, he's not my stepbrother, but he was born and raised in the same building that I was born and raised in Inwood. So I did make up a story that he was my stepbrother, the father died, his father, he didn't want to hear it. No, mom was sick, or I know, whatever the story was.
Yeah.
It was a teeth jerker. But I needed that only for the captain's permission.
Mm.
So my shifts were covered for work. That I had, I could take 3 days and see if I could find my stepbrother and give him that message or whatever. So
now you had a list of your friends, but you did not really know whether that list with addresses was actually up to date, or did you? Were you fairly sure?
Again, I go back to my military experience, which was only a couple of years prior to this, now today, when you hear about someone's address, you think of a geographical place, like a city or a state or
right.
a county. Or, in a military address, it's only the actual unit that you're in. It doesn't say the 4th Division or the 5th Division or Headquarters Battalion or Charlie Company in Camp Lejeune. It would just give you your military address as far and the Army Post Office. That was the key in San Francisco. They knew where to send it, but you couldn't tell by an address geographically where they would be. So the question would be, he's in the 1st Cavs, the 1st Cavalry Division.
Yeah.
So, and they had a unique patch on their shoulders, and it was a horse's head with a line across it, and half the line was black, and the other half of the patch was yellow. I was looking for that. If I was looking for Dugan, that's where I would be looking. But I found Collins the very first day I was there. I found Collins immediately, and I went back to Collins' barracks with Collins, and they got out of all of their uniforms and everything. Well, not uniforms, you know. They just got rid of their weapons and all. And we went back into town and found a drinking place, establishment. I wouldn't call it a pub. And while we were there, I saw a big Texan with a cowboy hat on, and he had the first cow patch on his uniform. Oh, by the way, everybody I was with there was in uniform. They were all in the military, except for me. I had a light pair of dungarees on with like a plaid shirt, which made me stick out. But when I saw the man with the cowboy hat on, and then I saw the patch, I asked him, you know, confirmed he was with the 1st Cavalry, and I asked him where the 1st Cavalry was, and he told me where it was. It was up in Onkay, up in the Highlands. So, and it, when he asked me why, because he's looking at this guy in civilian clothes, I told him, well, I was looking for my stepbrother, and he's in Charlie Company, and da-da-da-da. I had the military address. Oh, yeah, they're up there. I said, can you tell me how I can get up there? He says, well, if you want, I'm going up 8 o'clock in the morning. If you're on a tarmac at 0800, you can fly up it by plane. I love the way he said, my plane. He was the mechanic, the chief mechanic for the plane. So he flew around. He considered it his plane. So that was nice. Kept partying all night with Collins and his MP friends. They were all MPs. And the next morning, they put me in one of their military police jeeps, and I had three MPs escort me to the airfield, which meant that I didn't have to stop at any security gates or any check-in for papers or anything like that. They literally drove me right up to the cowboy's plane. The cowboy recognized me right away. Again, I stuck out by being in civilian clothes and fairly long hair and a mustache. And he said, oh, yeah, Onkay, that's right, 1st Cav, yeah. Come on, right on here. He checked me off, put my name on the list, and I got on the plane. And while I was on the plane, there was, no, not yet. That was just the first flight to Onkay. Yeah, that was another plane. I'm sorry. I don't want to mix it up. So they took me to Onkay. I got off at Onkay, and when I found where Dugan would normally be, I was told that outfit headed north, and they didn't know where north, but they assured me that after I told them my sob story, they told me that if I wrote a letter to him, they would make sure he got it that afternoon. So then I asked him, I said, you don't even know where he is, and you can guarantee me that the mail would be delivered to him this afternoon? And they said, yeah. How is that? They said, we've got a 1,300 mail run. Like I was an idiot. And maybe I was. Everybody depended on the mail over there. So there was a 1 o'clock flight taking the mail to the guys, wherever they were. So I said, could I get on that 1 o'clock flight or the 1,300 air run, a mail run? And the guy looked at me deadpan. He said to me, you got here, didn't you? In other words, you're not supposed to be here. What's the difference? Up there, you're not supposed to be there either, too. But if you got here, get there. So I raced down to the airfield again. And on the way down to the airfield, going through a jungle road, there was nothing there. The base was a mile or two away from the airfield. But that mile or two was nothing, just forest. So I'm going down this road with nothing on, no vehicles, no people, no buildings, no nothing. And I said, and I'm racing to get to that 1 o'clock flight. And I see a vehicle coming going in the same direction I am. So I flagged it down, and who did it turn out to be but Kevin McClune, who lived in Inwood, but also originally came from Long Beach, Long Island, where a lot of Inwoodites live today. And he hung out in Inwood. He kept an apartment in Inwood. And he was on my list of people that were over there at the time. So it's the second day, and I literally run into Kevin McClune. So, again, he picked me up, took me right to the plane. Kevin was a former Marine, but at the time he was serving as a civilian employee with two other guys who were in the same jeep with him for fixing helicopter radio scrambling devices so they wouldn't be detected by the enemy. So, but the point is that they were all civilian employees of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in the jeep with them, and they drove me right to the front door of the plane. So I again didn't have to go through any security or any, you know, equivalent to checking my tickets or my bags or anything like that. All the time I'm still carrying this duffel bag with beer in it. So I get off, and I said, this is the mail run? Yeah, okay. You want to put my name on air? And I said, well, what's your name? I gave my name. They said they asked me my rank. And I said, I'm a civilian. And then I saw the other three civilians there with me, all military, working for the military. And they had some sort of military signs on them, or shirts or pants or whatever, that designated them as if with the military. So the guy just assumed I'm all part of this outfit, and he let me go on board. So that took me up to the northern part of Vietnam, up just below Hue to a place called Phu Bai. And while I was on that flight up to Phu Bai, there were two young soldiers who sat next to me along the side of in the plane. And they said, who are you? What are you doing? I told them what I was doing. Oh, they were laughing. One guy was laughing. He thought it was hilarious. The other guy was terrified. He said, no, get away. I don't want to be seen with this guy. This guy's going to get in trouble. So I promised I would never talk to him again. I will never do nothing with him. Forget about him. But the other guy, I promised, he told me that he was in the same company with Dugan, that he actually knew Dugan. So I said, this is perfect. I'm just going to follow this guy. I didn't need any more directions. He was going to Dugan, so I followed him. So I told him that. I'm not going to bother you. Nobody's going to see that I'm with you. But when you get off, I'm just going to follow you. And however, wherever you go, if you can slow them down just a little bit, if I'm having trouble to keep up with you, you know?
Yeah.
So that was it. So I followed them, and they took me up into the hills, and they took me to a helicopter base called LZ Tombstone. And from there, again, the same routine. The guy went, they went in to check in to go back to Charlie Company or Bravo Company, whatever. And after they left, I went in and I said, they told me it was an 1800, lift chopper going right there. So I said to the guy in the operations tent, I said, you got a chopper going up to LZ Jane at 1800? He says, yes, sir. So I said, do you want to put my name down there? The name is John Donahue. And the guy says, John Donahue. He says, okay. He says, what's your rank, sir? I said, I'm a civilian. He says, a civilian? I says, yeah. So you're going to have to talk to Major Flynn or something like that. So with that, I hear a guy behind me say, who has to talk to me? So I said, I guess it's me. And who are you? I told him I was checked on you, and I was trying to get on that chopper to LZ Jane. He says, what's your business up there? I said, well, I can't really tell you, Major. So he says, oh, not one of you guys, or something to that effect. So he said, did you eat anything yet? By this time, it's late in the afternoon. So I says, no. He says, come on. So he took me to dinner in another tent to the officers' club, and I got a kick out of it. That I'm sitting there talking to this guy, and he's trying to figure out who I am. And finally, I said, Major, I would love to tell you. But even if I could tell you, I said, you wouldn't believe me anyway. So that just furthered their suspicion that I was, you know, whoever I was, I was legal, proper, or whatever. So I got on that flight. And then next thing I know, I'm on this outpost up by the DMZ. When I landed, it's depicted well in the movie, except the structures weren't there. There was no structures. Just guys in a couple of dugouts, you know, holes in the ground. And the guy, sergeant, says to me, who are you? So I told him who I was. What are you doing up here? I said, I'm looking for my stepbrother. His name is Ricky Dugan. And he said, hey, what are you doing with him? I got to come up and tell him some bad news from the family back home. He says, okay, all right. He says, get Dugan in here. So they got Dugan in by the radio. Dugan comes in. And meanwhile, the sergeant said, get in the hole here. The hooch, I think he called it. Get in the hooch here. And he put a raid jacket over me. Not a jacket, a poncho. And he hid me there. Dugan comes in. And I hear Dugan says, yeah, Sarge, you called me in. He was in an ambush post out, maybe, I don't know, a quarter mile out into the woods or half a mile. I don't know what the distance was. And he says, no, I don't want you. This guy does. And he pulled the poncho off me. And he said, Tricky, don't you? Oh, my God, what the hell are you doing here? So I told him, I'd come over to bring you a beer. He says, no, really, Tricky, who are you with? I said, no, really, Ricky, I'm with you. I'm with nobody, just me. So that started a crazy night. And I got stuck there another day, and I finally got a ride out of there on a chopper that took me to Quang Tri, where I got the plane to Phuket. And then from Phuket, I started down the road because I wanted to get there that night. I couldn't spend another day away, and the night was controlled by Charlie, so I was stopped. I had to go back, and the next day I came down by convoy back to the port I was originally in, and my ship was gone.
Okay, so let's bring us up to date. Last night, you know, the movie about this epic Vietnam War beer run, you know, was indeed shown on Apple Plus, and is actually, you know, today it's going to be starting in theaters all over the United States. You know, some of the greatest and best known actors, you know, like Zac Efron and Bill Murray and Russell Crowe, telling this insane true story, you know, about sneaking into Vietnam and handing out beers and linking up there.
It's been exciting for me at my age. I'm 81. I have a number of grandchildren. I've taken them to on set. A number of them were in the movie. They had little parts, but still, they were on the set, and they met all the actors, and they actually got paid for it. We thought that was great.
Oh.
Of course, it was a job, so I like that, too. So it's been a blast, to tell you the truth, but it's been going on because of the pandemic, the delays, but it's been going on for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
And enough already.
Well, It's a great movie, and it's one, as I say, it's no, you know, mean feat to have it already listed like one of the best movies of 2022. And we want to, again, you know, wish you lots of luck with it. Well, we're delighted to have you on today, and. It is. It's a great movie, and we want to wish you all the luck in the world with it. And we look forward very much to having it in theaters right across the United States. And Chick Donahue, a lot of your friends are still around in Wood, and you must have many great stories that come from Vietnam and long may it last.
Adrian, can I say one more thing?
Yes.
I love the best part of the whole story is the four guys that I found over there are all alive. They were all healthy, aged, but healthy. And we get away together every once in a while for a meal or something with our wives. And the four of us, five of us, those four and myself, we just look at each other and laugh. Thank God we're still here. This wasn't on the schedule.
This, I know. It's great. It's great, and it's a great story. And good luck to you. And thanks a lot. Okay.
Thanks,
Chick.
Thank
and
bye.
Friends, you are listening to Irish Radio, Irish Radio Network USA, and this is the Flannelly Show coming to you live from New York.